Good morning. This is Weekend Ozarks at Large for Sunday, June 22nd, 2014. I'm Christina Karnatz.
And I'm Antoinette Grajeda. The 64th annual Opera in the Ozarks runs through July 18th at Inspiration Point near Eureka Springs, with performances held at the Arend Arts Center in Bentonville on June 29th, July 6th, and July 11th. This season includes Così fan tutte, Into the Woods, Gianni Schicchi, and Suor Angelica. Tickets and more information available at opera.org.
Ahead on this edition of Weekend Ozarks, what has been termed by some as mommy blogging has become big business in the area. We learn about the legalities of earning money for blogs and reviews. Plus, Antoinette takes us behind the scenes at the National Weather Service in Tulsa.
But first, post-secondary enrollment in distance education courses, especially those offered online, is on the rise. According to a 2011 report from the National Center for Education Statistics, the percentage of undergraduates who took any distance education courses rose from 16% in 2003 to 2004 to 20% in 2007 to 2008. According to an NCES report released earlier this month, 16,702 Arkansas students were enrolled exclusively in distance education courses in the fall of 2012. During the upcoming fall semester, the University of Arkansas will begin offering its first start-to-finish online bachelor's degree program, a Bachelor of Science in Business Administration. This program is an addition to the approximately 350 unique courses and 29 degree, licensure, and certificate programs offered online by the U of A. Gary Ferrier, Associate Dean for Undergraduate Programs in the Sam M. Walton College of Business, says from conception to approval, creating the four-year online program took almost 2 years. Ferrier says the university created this specific program for a number of reasons.
Online bachelor's in business is the most popular online degree in the U.S., so there's a big market for it. Second, the reputation of the Walton College is one that we would like to leverage and expand upon and be able to reach out to people in other parts of the state who might not be able to come here. For people who are working but need a bachelor's degree to move up in their company and to reach out into the region and hopefully beyond.
Although it is an option, not all students enrolled in distance education are taking all of their courses online. Javier Reyes, Vice Provost for Distance Education, says the university has more than 4,000 students taking at least one online course. Citing fall 2013 numbers, he says around 1,200 students are taking only online courses. Reyes says tuition for online and on-campus courses are the same, but the fees students pay differ. Students enrolled in only online courses, for example, don't have to pay fees that would give them access to the health center on the university's Fayetteville campus. However, Ferrier says, the cost for online courses would include fees that pay for certain educational services.
You do have access to the library, to the Enhanced Learning Center, to the Career Center, and all those student services that are part of the learning process.
So when you think about those, it would be the Center for Educational Access. When we talk about students with disabilities, we're thinking of the Enhanced Learning Center, which would be tutoring, the Quality Writing Center, the library. They get access to all of those.
While students could make the trip to campus to use these services, they are accessible online. The university offers self-paced courses as well as more traditional courses that have firm deadlines for assignments and tests. Ferrier says exams, which can be taken online, are proctored by a company called ProctorU.
And so the student sits at their computer, but they have a webcam and somebody's watching them to make sure that no one's whispering answers to them or that they're not opening their book if they're not allowed to use their book and so on.
And they monitor what's on their screen, right, so that you don't Google the answer. So it's an interesting process because it allows us to check identity. So the proctors from this company ask you some questions from public databases about you, so be able to verify your identity. You have to show your ID, and then they start the exam for you. If there are some issues with the exam, they can help you. Just, hey, it's not loading correctly, they can take a note or tell you. Or when there's some, what it's called, the misbehaving, the student is misbehaving, they're turning away, somebody came in or somebody's talking to them, they can actually record that. And then it's then that video is sent to a faculty member, and it's run through our academic integrity policy at the University of Arkansas.
Flexibility is one of the major benefits of enrolling in online courses. Gary Ferrier, Associate Dean for Undergraduate Programs in the Business College, says the online courses can be beneficial to traditional on-campus students who are studying abroad or who get called up for active duty. Online courses can also benefit students who are working or participating in an internship during the day by allowing them to take a class in their spare time. In addition to providing flexibility for students, Javier Reyes, Vice Provost for Distance Education, says the process of creating the courses has helped faculty members change the way they think about teaching.
Different departments will work differently, but what we do is once a faculty member is selected to be the one that creates this course, then we pair them up with an instructional designer and they go through a development process together. But it's the faculty of the University of Arkansas creating these courses. And in many departments, there's a lot of discussions about who should be the one that drives that process. You're actually talking to two of the economics faculties who have actually created online courses in the Department of Economics in the Walton College. So we went through the motion of working with the instructional designers and really changing your understanding of how you're going to teach in this new modality for us. But for some of the students, it's a modality they know themselves.
It really makes you think a lot more about what you're doing. And everyone I've talked to and I would agree is that by going through this and having taught online, it makes you a better teacher, period, in any environment.
With the Bachelor of Science in Business Administration degree being offered completely online starting this fall, it's conceivable that a student may never step foot on campus until he or she arrives to participate in a graduation ceremony. However, Reyes says he wants online students to feel that they are part of the University of Arkansas.
So we're trying to make sure that the students online see themselves as part of the campus. They see themselves as Razorbacks. They identify with the University of Arkansas. And you were talking about what is the benefits that they can get as that other students on campus get. And it's, well, their names will be on Senior Walk. Those are students that their degree is recognized everywhere because it has the seal of the University of Arkansas. So that's the biggest benefit. We didn't want to have this degree or any online degree from the University of Arkansas to be seen as a separate degree. We want it to be part of the same ensemble that we have, part of the same ecosystem for the university. And we're trying to make sure that both students get some benefit because as we grow more online students, we may need more supplemental instruction. Well, those are students on campus that have scholarships to do those kinds of support systems. Well, we'll need more students like that. So there's a sort of a nice environment which if you grow more online, you'll need more face-to-face. So we're trying to make sure that it doesn't drive resources one way or another, but that it benefits both sides.
More information is available at online.uark.edu.
What is called by some as mommy blogging is becoming a big business. What started as a cottage industry of parents posting pictures and stories about the challenges and charm of family life has become a portal for advertisers, marketers, and entrepreneurs. Only a handful of bloggers make enough money to give up their day job. A survey of mommy bloggers by online magazine Type A Parent found almost half make less than $250 per month from their posts. Northwest Arkansas Motherload, a site representing parents who blog in our area, has a list of around 40 active bloggers, and say our area has the highest concentration of bloggers in the state. So, how do Northwest Arkansas moms look to monetize their content and get paid? And can we still trust their stories, reviews, and advice that those moms post online? Sarah Birmingham has this report.
You flick through the Sunday papers, and you see the adverts, the coupons, You see that slightly different typeface and something that doesn't quite look like the rest of the stories, and you squint and you see that it's an advertorial. But how does that work online? Here in Northwest Arkansas, home to the world's largest retailer and host to vendors who account for the biggest advertising dollars in the U.S. outside car manufacturing, a symbiotic relationship is growing up between PR agencies, advertisers, and what you might once have called mommy bloggers. Many prefer the term parent blogger, or simply blogger. The agencies that caught them are in no doubt about what to call them. Influencers. A valuable new tool for advertisers to get us to do what advertisers have always wanted us to do, buy their client's product. Stephanie McCratic is one of those mommy bloggers. She started her blog, Evolved Mommy, in 2009 after moving to Northwest Arkansas from Little Rock. She says she now has 10,000 monthly unique viewers. Here's how she got started.
My husband said, why don't you start a blog? And I didn't really know what that meant, but I thought it sounded fabulous. So I started Evolved Mommy and got into a playgroup. And Evolved Mommy took this tech focus because my playgroup moms were asking me how to update their iPhones, how to justify an iPad, how to use a flip camera. And before I knew it, I was living in this small town, but this community had built up around me locally and nationally. And that was a really cool experience.
A recent survey by parent blogging magazine Type A Parent found only 1 in 4 parent bloggers make more than $500 per month. Pay-per-click ad revenue is only really going to be a money spinner for bloggers with high traffic, say 300,000 unique views per month. According to Type A Parent survey, the top revenue source for mommy bloggers is sponsored posts. Stephanie McCratic says she had been blogging about a year when she received her first request to post sponsored content.
I was really flattered, but it wasn't a match. And so I knew that it was part of that I had achieved a certain level of influence, but they didn't really care about the relevance. And that kind of opened the floodgates. I got some pitches, and I continue to get pitches that almost feel gross because, you know, here's a quick $50 if you'll do X, Y, and Z. And a lot of times they'll ask for a blog post and so many social shares. And what a lot of agencies and brands don't realize is, one, I'm spending my social capital to do that, and I only have so much. And two, writing a blog post is actually a lot of work if you're going to do it right. And so you are asking me to take time away from my family and away from my passions to write about you for a dollar amount that does not meet what I'm putting in.
You may have noticed Collective Bias's current headquarters on South Main Street in Bentonville. But the agency is building new offices just off I-49, having outgrown the storefront space. Started in 2009, Collective Bias employs more than 100 people and has offices in New York, Chicago, San Francisco, Minneapolis, Toronto, Canada, and London, England. The company hosts a community of around 3,000 bloggers. They call themselves a shopper social media agency. Courtney Lawless, VP of Communities at Collective Bias, says bloggers work with them for a couple of reasons.
It's a sense of community. So you have your community that will help you share and like and give you support and answer questions. But then the other piece is they make money in this by being a part of Collective Bias. So they would apply for what we call shop opportunities. So a lot of other companies will send bloggers items to review through the mail. They get the item, they do a review, include the entire process. So we tie in the retailer, the product, and the experience. The opportunity might be go to Walmart, pick up the movie Disney Frozen, and what are you going to do with that movie to incorporate it into your life? And so they will go shopping for the item and whatever items they're going to do, maybe to put together a party. And then they will go home and then document that entire party process to their readers, tying, like I said, the retailer to the product to the experience.
Lawless says bloggers are paid anywhere between $125 to thousands of dollars for posting about these so-called shop opportunities. She says mommy bloggers are attractive to advertisers because of their authenticity.
These are real people talking about real experiences. They're incorporating their families and their personal lives into things. They're taking pictures inside their home where you're seeing the pile of laundry or, you know, the fresh cut flower, whatever it is. And their children, they're opening their doors and saying, I'll photograph my child and show them to you. And you'll see the chocolate on the face, or, you know, they're opening their doors into their homes. And I think that's what's really appealing to their followers, and it's appealing to the brands too.
So how do we pick out trustworthy content on blogs when so much of it has been paid for? The Federal Trade Commission introduced regulations in 2009 and updated them last year, targeting bloggers and sponsored content. Patsy Watkins is professor of journalism at the University of Arkansas, and she teaches ethics.
If they're receiving something free for a mention of a certain product, or if they're getting actually paid cash for mentioning a product, and then the third is an endorsement for an advertiser or a client, which they might do outside the context of blogging, but they might do it in some other form of social media, such as a Facebook mention or a Twitter mention. And so those are the three places where they're supposed to note where they're getting this material compensation of some sort for these mentions. What is recommended by the FTC is that they have some sort of disclosure. And this disclosure can be as simple as saying in the blog post, oh, and I get such and such free diapers from so-and-so, but they are really good. You know, they just have to mention it, something like that. They don't have to have some sort of emblem that says disclosure.
Both Stephanie McCratick of Evolved Mommy and Courtney Lawless at Collective Bias started as bloggers and have spun their blogs into careers in social media marketing. And they both say that while it's nice to make money from your blog, maintaining credibility with your readers is of utmost importance. There's no point doing all the hard work of building a following, only to jeopardize it by endorsing the wrong products or saturating your feed with sponsored content. And it's certainly not going away. Old media bastions such as the New York Times, Washington Post, and Wall Street Journal now offer various kinds of sponsored content. And market research firm eMarketer predicts advertisers will be spending $3.2 billion per year on sponsored content by 2017. Sarah Birmingham, Ozarks at Large.
When you connect the dots too early, you can easily miss the real story, the whole story. Connections and nuance go missing. At Morning Edition, we focus on collecting the dots before we try to connect them. Only then do we consider what it all means together. Listen each weekday. It's Morning Edition from NPR News.
Tune in each weekday morning between 5 and 9 to hear Morning Edition on KUAF.
A blessing can come in many forms. Formally, it can be a rite to encourage a good life or strength through a challenging episode. Informally, it can be a cashier wishing you well as she hands you your receipt. Pastor Clint Schneckloth is the lead pastor at Good Shepherd Lutheran Church in Fayetteville and the author of Mediating Faith, Faith Formation in a Transmedia Era. He recently discussed blessings with Ozarks at Large's Kyle Kellums, who began by mentioning that blessings, graduations, weddings, groundbreakings seem to come with a transition in life.
We have this group of women that makes quilts for all the seniors that are graduating from high school.
Oh, wow.
And they spend the whole year making these quilts. And in some cases, what they'll do is they'll incorporate things from the kids' lives into the quilt, like a T-shirt that they had when they were younger, or one young woman who graduated from our church, her mom brought an old Easter dress that she had from when she was in elementary school, and they cut that apart and made it into the squares, you know? So then we give those quilts to them, and it's this, yeah, real powerful moment of kind of honoring them as they're transitioning from being a child to being an adult, mm-hmm. from living at home to going to school.
I'm wondering, and of course this would vary for every person who's receiving or every person who's offering a blessing, but I guess everyone sees a blessing as a different sort of thing, whether it's support, whether it's, I don't know, a call for protection. I don't know.
Well, our liturgical theorists, I think, would say that part of what people are doing there is there are certain kinds, there are certain things in our lives that we feel like we need some kind of liturgy for, or a rite. You need a rite. And I really do think that transcends any one particular faith tradition and is kind of this almost kind of global. You know, there are certain things in people's lives that almost all cultures ritualize, whether that's like the transition to adulthood.
Like a bar mitzvah.
Right. Bar mitzvah, confirmation, marriage, death.
Sure.
Birth, you know, those kind of major points. And what's interesting is how people who maybe they've even been trained that liturgy is inappropriate, that you're supposed to be more spontaneous in your faith or whatever. Then suddenly these moments, they're like, is there a formal prayer for this? Hmm. Is there, all of a sudden you're busting out a hymnal when you didn't even know that they were going to want one. You know, there's something about those moments that people want. And what I think is going on there is the tradition. Human beings over time having put together like a specific kind of language to use in those moments, that there's something about that that has power. All of a sudden you want to go to things that you've memorized or that have been carefully crafted. I can't remember exactly how she says this, but Anne Lamott has a line, I think, in one of her books where she talks about how Episcopalian liturgy is a series of words that human beings have figured out over time that they can say them and not be struck down by God, so they've stuck with them.
right.
Like, oh, this worked and we didn't die, so we're going to keep saying these things because it works. You know, and I think that's part of what liturgy is. It's like, wow, okay, this worked with God and us, and so we're going to keep using it.
We're talking about transitions that are planned, graduations, marriages, things that people want to have happen. But then you have sometimes changes in life that you didn't see coming or didn't want to happen. And people will again look for guidance or look for help or look for strength from perhaps ritual, perhaps blessings. And I'm thinking about people whose homes and lives have been torn apart by storms or something like that. Mm-hmm. And then there's still a sort of different desire looking for help, right?
Yeah. I'm remembering, this is a while ago, but it was probably the most powerful ritual moment in U.S. history that I can think about in my own memory, but around September 11th, and how all these people kind of poured down there, and there were people from all different faith traditions, and they had those prayer services and memorial services, and you had people coming together from religious traditions who most of the time wouldn't even consider praying together necessarily, but the moment was so important that people were willing to risk even, you know, praying across faith lines or religious lines.
Is there ever something too trite for a blessing? Because, you know, I know that some religions have the blessing of the animals, which I think is a wonderful thing, but I guess some people might think, oh gosh, I shouldn't ask for a blessing about this, that this seems too small to ask something that seems so important to others.
Yeah. I've wondered about that too. You get asked in different contexts to pray over or bless things that'll surprise you. I can remember when I was doing my clinical pastoral education. This is when I lived in the Twin Cities. And you're in the hospital every day, and you're on a floor, and or you're on call, and you're getting called in to pray with people or bless people. And the two biggest surprises about things you could pray for or bless that had never occurred to me, you know, you think about people who are in the hospital. Mm-hmm. Typically, the reason why they aren't being released from the hospital yet after surgery is because they have to get their system running again, and that includes passing gas and things like that, right? And so I actually, for the first time when I was on CPE, prayed that people would fart.
But you know what? I get that because that's yeah.
Right? Which is a transition too, right? Like you want to get out of the hospital and the thing that's keeping you from getting out of that, right? And I remember the first time the person felt nervous asking for that as a prayer request. And then we were like, well, no, we should pray for this then because this is what you need right now. And so that was one example. Or before people would go in for surgery, like a blessing over a certain part of their body that was going to be operated on or whatever. And I guess maybe it only sounds trivial until it's the very thing that you need the most. And then it's no longer trivial at all.
I think about the responsibility then that you or any man or woman who leads a congregation or helps lead a congregation has when you're asked to do that. Because they're asking you to do something that's very important to them. And you get asked to do that a lot.
Yeah.
And you can't, not to be trite, but you can't phone it in. Or you shouldn't, right? I mean, because everyone's, like you said, when that is something that's important to that person, it's important to that person.
Yeah.
So that's got to be emotional. Not maybe emotionally, but that's a lot to ask.
I have some good friends who bought and they're refurbishing it's actually an old, I think it used to be part of either maybe J.B. Hunt or maybe the Joneses, that the Joneses were trucking, industry up in Springdale, right? And there's this long shipping barn in downtown Springdale that they bought, and they're in the process of refurbishing it into a facility that different artists can rent out space, and they're doing different kinds of like woodwork or metalwork in there and that kind of thing. And they asked me to come up and bless this place as they're getting it up to code and doing what they need to do. And it was funny because, you know, when you go in and you plan something like that, on the one hand, you want it to be personal for them and to make sense and be meaningful for them. But then on the other hand, going back to what we were talking about before, there's something about using the ritual that's already in place, you know, taking blessings that people have used in other times and places and using that. And so in that case, what I did was I came up and I actually just brought my little occasional services book that I have as a pastor, and we just used this blessing for a building. And we used it as is. And there was some power about that, but then the place evokes the what's different about what you do. So we went around, and this is actually kind of fun. Blessings of a building. One of the things that you can do in our tradition is you're maybe encouraged to have some water and a branch, and then it's called asperges. It's like you're casting water from the tree branch around in the space. And so we got a bowl and tore off a little branch from a tree that was near this trucking building. And then we were going around the space and we're just like, you know, casting water onto dusty corners and shelves and all this kind of thing. But then in the middle of doing that, one of the guys who actually works in there happened to be there. So we're going around and he's like, what are you guys doing? Right?
Yeah.
So we had an option there at that point. We either keep going and don't answer his question, keep trying to do the right, or we pause the right, talk with him for a while, invite him along or whatever. And so that's what we ended up doing. And it was this kind of funny mix of we're in the middle of the prayers and the blessing, and then all of a sudden we're in a conversation for 15 minutes. And then a worker comes in who's working on the roof. And then finally we get back around to it. But actually, that was a powerful part of it, too. And then he came along for the rest of the casting of the water and the prayers and just kind of checked it out. The emotional power of the whole event was a mix of that, kind of the interruption and the local. I have the same thing happen when I take communion to people who are homebound. Sometimes either they can't hear well, or if they deal with memory loss issues, they may forget in the middle of doing the communion liturgy that you're even doing that. So they'll start talking to you again. And so you can either ram on through and force it, or you can answer their questions and have a conversation in the middle of what you think is a religious rite. And I don't know.
Well, finally, and we didn't talk about this, just occurred to me as we're having this conversation, but there can be sometimes a bit of controversy about the simple word blessed. You know, some people they don't want to be told to have a blessed day. Some people, and I just wonder, do you have any sort of opinion about the word? I mean, who knew that this word would become controversial? But for some people, it has.
What are you allowed to bless?
Yeah,
and what's controversial?
Yeah, and what if I am of a different faith and I say to you, "Have a blessed day," or "You have my blessing"? Some people recoil from that. It's like, well, don't worry about me. I mean, I always see it like, hey, you're basically sending me good thoughts, whether we're across faiths or whatever. I'll take it.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just wondering.
Well, you see people post that on Facebook now if they're trying to be sensitive to the variety of traditions of people that they're friends with on Facebook, is they'll say something like, hey, I'm asking for prayers or positive vibes
or whatever you
do.
Yeah.
Send them my way kind of thing.
Yeah.
That goes again to this whole thing of this transcends any, regardless of where you are, you still want the vibes or the thoughts.
That was Ozarks at Large's Kyle Kellums discussing blessings with Pastor Clint Schnickloth, the lead pastor at Good Shepherd Lutheran Church in Fayetteville and author of Mediating Faith, Faith Formation in a Transmedia Era.
This week in This American Life,
I am pleased to present here on the Brooklyn Academy of Music Opera House stage.
We have true stories like we always do. This time, turned into a musical, turned into opera. Also,
this is crazy.
We will never speak of that mouse again.
Sashir Zameda, Mike Birbiglia, Stephen Merritt, this week.
Sunday at 10 a.m. on 91.3 FM.
In Northwest Arkansas, it seems like the weather can change in an instant. One day it's sunny and 75. The next, a cold front moves in and it's 45 and raining. During severe weather, you can get weather warnings on your phone, radio, or television. You may even hear this sound echoing through the air. The National Weather Service, which is headquartered in Silver Spring, Maryland, is the group responsible for issuing weather warnings. The organization employs about 5,000 people in 122 weather forecast offices across the country. The office in charge of issuing forecasts for Northwest Arkansas is located in a tall, nondescript building on the outskirts of Tulsa, Oklahoma. The structure is comprised of alternating layers of dark windows and a grayish concrete. The Tulsa National Weather Service office occupies about 10,000 square feet on the third floor. A National Weather Service display that includes old weather instruments, posters, and a tornado simulator greets visitors stepping off the elevator. After entering the dark wooden doors to the right, walk past the receptionist desk and photos of tornadoes on the wall, and you will find yourself in the office of meteorologist in charge, Stephen F. Piltz. Piltz has been in Tulsa since 1990, and the office has been located in this building since 1993. Piltz is originally from Murfreesboro, Illinois, which was struck by the country's deadliest tornado in 1925. According to the National Weather Service, what the organization calls the Tri-State Tornado tore a 219-mile path across Missouri, Illinois, and Indiana. The tornado resulted in 695 deaths, 234 of which occurred in Murfreesboro, a record for a single community from such a disaster. Piltz says this, combined with an F4 tornado that struck the town about 4 years before his birth, really had an effect on Murfreesboro residents.
Growing up, you could just tell that the town really kind of freaked out every time it got stormy in the spring. And I think that has made an impression like, wow, the folks really are worried about that. And people who know weather can control the mood of a town. And it kind of just built from there.
Piltz's interest in weather eventually blossomed into a career in meteorology. The Tulsa office employs about 25 people, and there is someone there 24/7. There are typically three people in the office at any given time, but Piltz says this number can double or triple on severe weather nights. The Tulsa office is responsible for creating day-to-day forecasts and issuing weather warnings for 7 counties in Northwest Arkansas and 25 counties in eastern Oklahoma. Pilz explains they work on a sister station concept, so if one office goes down, another one can back it up. If the Tulsa office wasn't functional, for example, an office in Norman, Oklahoma would take over. Exiting Pilz's office and heading down a hallway to your left, you pass the library and break room. Further down the hall, blue cubicle walls appear to your right and to your left. The River Forecast Center is located on the other side of the left wall.
They deal with the water issues from Colorado back across Kansas, Oklahoma, into West Arkansas and North Texas. Since it's kind of dry at the moment, I don't think a whole lot's going on. Although they still have hourly analysis they have to do, and they kind of get involved in some of the drought things too, because they know what the water levels are and they keep track of all that, and they can tell communities, yes, you're this low and this is kind of what you need to be better, and so they can help with water supply things. The weather forecast office is all over here. Say hi, Ray.
Hi.
The cubicles on the right are positioned in an open layout, so everyone can easily communicate from one desk to another. Pilz says this is by design.
The openness seems to work best. We've seen the studies, and we joke about it some, that it's the noisy cockpits that survive when airliners are in trouble. And typically, if a cockpit's quiet, that's the airliner that's more in trouble, more likely not to catch everything it needs to catch. It may have a better chance of crashing, but the cockpit that, where there's constant chatter, someone always bringing up an idea, someone's always pointing something out, that tends to be the cockpit that survives, and that's kind of the mode we operate in. Generally, the noisier, the better things are. It's when the room gets really quiet is something's gone wrong, that suddenly the storms aren't doing what they're supposed to be doing, and now we're all intensely looking at things as opposed to chit-chatting back and forth. So you can tell that a noisy room is a good room for us generally.
One wall of this room is lined with large windows, which meteorologist in charge Steve Pilz says offers a pretty good view when a nasty storm is rolling in. Across the way, 8 computer monitors sit atop the white tabletop of a large corner workstation. A handful of flat-screen televisions are mounted to the upper part of the cubicle walls. This is where a lot of data is collected and analyzed. As Pilz sits down to look at an image on one of the computer screens, he talks to a colleague about what looks like a large swath of color hovering over Oklahoma.
We send out 2 radar pulses, one this way and one this way, and we compare the results of the two. And right now in this purple area, we're getting more signal back from the horizontal than we are the vertical. So that tells us whatever we're seeing on the radar isn't a raindrop, it's not a cloud, it's something long. So it's probably a bug of some sort. This also tells us that the signal's kind of chaotic, and if this were a cloud, if this were rain or snow, this would all be one solid color, pretty much like this grapey purple color up in here. But since this is all scattered and low like this, that tells us that it's not just uniform, it's something kind of chaotic. And so we know from this it's pretty much not meteorological, it's not water vapor or ice or anything, and we know from this that it's something long. And I also know that this is the way the wind's blowing where these radar echoes are. It's coming from the southwest going to the northeast, but the stuff's coming this way, so it's kind of going against the wind too, so it's not drifting in the wind like a cloud would. So everything points to it's bugs.
In addition to radar, the Tulsa office has access to satellite imagery. The image on the screen was created by a thermal sensor on a satellite, and without it, Pilz says, they'd lose track of things at night. The thermal imagery is also helpful for spotting wildfires. Pilz says there have been circumstances when they've noticed a thermal signature in a rural area and notified authorities. This desk is also the area where meteorologists send out weather warnings. Pilz says sometimes it takes less than a second after striking the enter key before the warning is broadcast on television and radio. In addition to regular weather forecasts, this office is also in charge of producing specialized airport forecasts, which look at the height of clouds, visibility, and wind.
If we inappropriately forecast the weather too low, we've caused all the airlines to carry more fuel. We've caused them all to designate specific alternate airports that they will go to if they can't get in. And so we're cognizant of the fact that if we make a bad forecast, we've cost airlines money.
Because they have access to computer models as well as radar and satellite imagery, Steve Pilz says he often ends up with more data than you can shake a stick at. The trick is to pull useful parts from the different data sets to create as accurate a forecast as possible. Meteorologists in the Tulsa office communicate with Northwest Arkansas meteorologists, watch local television stations, listen to reports from local residents, and watch weather reports on social media to help shape their decisions.
The radar in the end only sees what's in the beam, and then the earth curves, and so at some point the radar beam is gaining altitude off the ground, and so we really don't know what's at ground level. We can only say what's going on maybe at, you know, 2,000, 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 feet. So we may see rotation at 3,000 feet, but not know if it's actually a tornado on the ground, or we may see a storm that is producing hail, but we don't really know what's finally reached the ground. So having them feedback information is great. So it's really, when the weather gets bad, meteorologists won't turn down information.
Walking through a door at the back of this room, you'll find yourself in another room full of computer servers that are stored in tall black metal cases.
And this is just all the guts to the computers out front. So like this. This is the brains of the Fort Smith radar, which over the years, electronics just keeps getting smaller and smaller. But that's, the signal comes from Fort Smith and it gets processed in here, and then we turn it back around and it shows up on your smartphone, on the web page, shows up on the TV stations if they're using the weather service radars. So all the guts to everything is back in here.
So the radar is in Fort Smith, but the information comes here?
Mm-hmm. So yeah, all the raw data comes up by a T1 circuit and then gets processed here. So in a sense, at least a part of the Fort Smith radar lives here.
Tulsa, by the way, has its own radar, which is located about 15 miles to the east along Highway 412. While Steve Piltz and his team work tirelessly to give the best forecast possible, it's important to remember that sometimes nature's just going to do whatever it wants.
It's a rewarding thing, but it's also very humbling, because you know that you shouldn't be overly proud about any one thing that you've done, because nature will fix that within the next few days. And so if you think, boy, we nailed that snow forecast, that probably means the next week we're going to mess something up. And so you know to work hard and be proud, but at the same time, don't get too excited that you think that you're all that, because you're really not. Nature still humbles all of us when it comes to bad weather.
If you'd like to check out the Northwest Arkansas Tulsa office, it will be hosting an open house Saturday, September 20th. For more information, visit weather.gov/Tulsa. This is Ozarks at Large.
This is Weekend Ozarks at Large. I'm Christina Karnatz.
And I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
It is time once again for our Sunday morning montage.
Yes, today's montage was created by our own Kyle Kellums. He was inspired by the theme of science.
He was. Science was never one of my favorite subjects in school.
Yeah, not my favorite. Yeah.
I'm interested in it, but not...
Just, it wasn't the one I was most passionate about, let's say that.
Yes, for sure. That's for sure. Well, there are several science-related events happening at libraries around our area this summer.
Mm-hmm.
One of which is happening this afternoon at the Alma Public Library. They're continuing their Mad Scientist movie marathon at 2 p.m. with a screening of Back to the Future.
That's the kind of science I can get into.
Yeah, I totally love that movie. Well, anyway, here is the Sunday morning montage based on science.
By these small candles in our darkness that we see before us, little by little, the dim outlines of that great plan that shapes the universe. And I am among those who think that for this reason, science has great beauty, and with its great spiritual strength will in time cleanse this world of its evils.
Nearly 14 billion years ago, expansion started. Wait, the earth began to cool, the autotrophs began to drool. Neanderthals developed tools, we built a wall.
We built the pyramids.
Math, science, history, unraveling the mystery that all started with a big bang.
Mr. President, technology required is easily within the means of even the smallest nuclear power. It requires only the will to do so.
But how is it possible for this thing to be triggered automatically and at the same time impossible to untrigger?
Mr. President, it is not only possible, it is essential.
He gains about 18 inches to bounce.
And your opinion is?
About 7 o'clock tonight, he's going to be in serious trouble.
From my heart and from my hand, why don't people understand my intention?
Welcome to my latest experiment. This is a big one, the one I've been waiting for all my life.
Well, it's a DeLorean, right?
Share with me, Marty. All your questions will be answered. Roll tape.
Okay. It's alive. It's alive. It's alive. It's alive. It's alive.
There's antimony, arsenic, aluminum, selenium, and hydrogen, and oxygen, and nitrogen, and rhenium, and nickel, neodymium, neptunium, germanium, and iron, americium, ruthenium, uranium, europium, zirconium, lutetium, vanadium, and lanthanum, and osmium, and astatine, and radium.
To see if you guessed the clips correctly in our Sunday morning montage, just go to our website, ozarksatlarge.com.
I'm Brooke Gladstone, and on this week's On the Media, terrorist group ISIS is dominating headlines, both for its ground war and its very strategic use of social media.
There was a gentleman from the National Counterterrorism Center who described this as peer-to-peer recruiting.
Don't miss this week's On the Media from WNYC.
Listen Sunday at 11 a.m. to KUAF 91.3 FM.
Good morning. It is Sunday, June 22nd, 2014, and this is Weekend Ozarks at Large. I'm Antoinette Grajeda. Joining me now is Becca Martin Brown, features editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
I'm so glad this is radio.
Why?
You can see me. You don't need to ask why. Moving day was yesterday.
Well, you're here, so you've survived.
I have survived, but I look like I got run over by the moving truck. So usually we talk about things to do. Mm-hmm. But I had to share another story with you today.
Please do.
I met this really cool lady last week.
Mm-hmm.
And I want you to meet her through me. Her name is Beatrice Carney, and she's almost 96. And she is a real live Rosie the Riveter.
Is she?
She lives in Bentonville. And I went looking to find her because the American Rosie the Riveter Association is looking for more members.
I didn't know there was an association.
And neither did I till I got a letter from them. They're in Alabama, and they're trying to sign up everybody who either worked in a factory or worked in a war job or did a lot of volunteer work during the war. And most of these people are in their 80s and 90s, and there's not really records about them. Even the women who worked, the women who had victory gardens, the women who collected metal during metal drives. And they want to get their stories. They're on like their fifth book of publishing Rosie the Riveter stories.
Oh, very cool.
This really cool lady had gotten married. She went home to New York City to work for Sperry Gyroscope Corporation, putting teeny tiny little mirrors on bomb sites with even tinier little screws. And she has really tiny hands and was good at it. So she worked there for a couple of years, lived with her parents, while her husband was serving in the Army Air Corps. And then she got to go join him. He was in, by that time, he was in Austin as a flight instructor, and she got to go join him. And I asked her, what was your favorite thing about getting back together with him? She said, I can't tell you that.
Okay, what was your second favorite thing? Anyway, she's really fascinating, and I hope that by telling her story that if you are, they call them Rosies,
okay,
or a Rosebud, which is a female descendant, or a Rivet, which is a male descendant,
okay,
that you will get a hold of the Rosie the Riveter Association and help them get all of these people signed up. You can just Google American Rosie the Riveter Association, or it's rosietheriveter.net.
Okay, well, maybe someone else out there has a Rosie or a Rosebud who would be interested in this.
Or a Rivet.
Or a Rivet.
And if you're looking for something fun to do this afternoon, Mountain Street Stage at the Fayetteville Public Library, my favorite place, 2 o'clock, free. And Sidewalk Sunday with Trike Theater at the Walmart Museum in Bentonville from 2 to 5, also free.
Thank you, Becca. Becca Martin Brown is Features Editor at Northwest Arkansas Newspapers.
Support for KUAF comes from Edible Oaks, Arkansas. This quarterly magazine focuses on food, farms, and culture in the Ozarks. Proceeds benefit hunger relief efforts through Feed Fayetteville and Feed Communities. More information, including subscriptions, available at edibleozarkansas.com.
A listener-supported service of the Department of Journalism and Fulbright College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Arkansas. This is KUAF 91.3 FM, Fayetteville, Rogers, Fort Smith, Alma.
Alma. Well, that's where the movie is this afternoon.
Mm-hmm. At the Alma, Back Alma to the Public Future. Garden.
Yeah,
I know where you'll be.
Yep. Well, it's one of my favorites.
I know.
Totally is.
I haven't seen it in a long time.
Yeah. Well, that radio signal, KUAF 91.3, is just one of many ways that we at Ozarks at Large can communicate with our listeners.
Yes, we have lots of social media applications that we try to use to stay in touch with our listeners. We have an Ozarks at Large Facebook page. We have an Instagram account. We have KUAF underscore radio. You can find us there on Instagram. We have an Ozarks at Large on Twitter, and a good old fashioned email. If you want to get in touch with us, you have a story idea, or you know, have a question about something that you heard, you can send us an email at ozarksatlarge@gmail.com.
That's right. I know earlier this week we had an email just, you know, saying, hey, we like what you do.
Right.
And we liked it. We like to hear from our emails. It does, or from our listeners through email. Yeah.
Absolutely. You know, always happy to know people are listening and that we're doing the right thing, that people enjoy what we're doing.
Right. Ozarks at Large is a production of KUAF. I'm Christina Karnatz.
And I'm Antoinette Grajeda.
Earlier, Becca Martin Brown mentioned that there is a concert across the street from the KUAF studios at the Fayetteville Public Library this afternoon. But she didn't mention who it was.
She didn't.
No.
Oh, that's right. She didn't.
She didn't. But at 2 o'clock, Dave Bear will be playing as part of the Mountain Street Stage Summer Music Series.
Well done.
Yeah. It's free.
It is free, absolutely free.
Yes.
2 to 4, bring the kids. And it's a nice way to just get out of the heat or the rain or whatever it decides to do today.
Mm-hmm.
And enjoy some free live music.
Totally. Well, we'll end with Dave Bear's song, Cast Your Vote. Thanks for listening and have a good Sunday.
Commentary, soundbite, and the like. Oh, dig a little deeper, work a little smarter. Know where you stand, cast your vote. Get on going, take your coat. Let them see you coming, gotta make it count. You gotta look them in the eye, get to what they're saying. Leave a quote. Cast your vote. So what's good for the gaggle? Touted by the goose, or is it made into a dagger or a shiny noose?